Willkommen, bienvenue, welcome to Open Air, to Open Air, to Open Air. A brief and inadequately performed teaser for one of my guests today, Keith Pinto, who takes on the role of MC in Cabaret at the Hill Barn Theater. Good afternoon, I'm David LaTulip, welcoming you indeed to our weekly magazine of the performing arts scene here in the Bay Area. Today, you'll also hear about Stephen Eden's chamber opera, Why Live at the P.O., based on the short story by Eudora Welty, being staged by the West Edge Opera. The composer is here, along with director Mark Straczynski. Acclaimed flamenco artist Yaelisa will be joined by her guitarist husband, Jason McGuire, known as El Rubio, to talk about their touring show, which also includes guests, artists from Spain. The music of Gustav Mahler is getting a semi-staged treatment envisioned by Michael Tilson Thomas with the San Francisco Symphony, Chorus, and Soloists this weekend. The director of Das Klagende Lied, James Dura, will share his contributions to the production. Stay with us. West Edge Opera presents the first snapshot presentation of chamber works by David Conte and John Sterling Walker, famous, William David Cooper and Will Dumlat, Heiger and Ishmael, Alden Jenks' Afterworld, and composer Stephen Eden's and librettist Michael O'Brien's Why I Live at the P.O., January 21st at 8 p.m. in Berkeley and the 22nd at 3 p.m. in San Francisco. The composer of that last work, Stephen Eden's, joins me in studio along with his director, Mark Straczynski, who joined West Edge Opera as artistic director in the fall of 2009, becoming general director in December of 2012. They'll talk about Why I Live at the P.O., based on the short story by Eudora Welty, written in 1941. Welty's book, The Optimist's Daughter, won the Pulitzer Prize in 1973, and she was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom, among numerous awards. Mark, Stephen, welcome to Open Air.
Thanks so much for having us.
Of course. I feel it's pertinent to inform listeners of what kind of story you're setting. So if you allow me, here's the prologue and the first scene, if I may. So the prologue, the back room of the post office of China Grove, Mississippi, early July, 1941. Sister, the narrator, has set up housekeeping there along with all the amenities of a cozy home. She begins to tell us the story of why she is living at the P.O. She had been doing fine until her sister, Stella Rondo, came home from Illinois, where she'd been briefly married to Mr. Whittaker, a former beau of Sister's. In scene one, Sister walks into the story she is telling back to her family home, back in time to the 4th of July. Sister narrates her story, pointing to an incarnation of herself in the kitchen 5 days earlier, contentedly performing domestic chores for her family. Her peace is shattered, I say shattered, when Stella Rondo arrives with a 2-year-old child named Shirley T., whom she insists is adopted. Well, Mama greets them ecstatically, but Sister expresses her doubts that Shirley T. could be adopted, noting a strong resemblance to both Mr. Whittaker and Papa Daddy, the family patriarch. If we were to cut off his beard, which of course he'd never do. Stella Rondo angrily demands that Sister make no future reference to her adopted child and flounces off to her room. Well, now that is some ripe stuff for dramatization.
I hardly feel like we need to do it now. We've just had this performance.
Well, Stephen, your score plays into that 1940s era of big band, gospel, and jazz-inspired music. I'm wondering, did you have to change or reduce the arrangement for this production of Snapshot?
Yeah, the opera's arranged for a sort of modified big band, about 16 pieces. So for the Snapshot production, I reduced that to 3 pieces, to a piano, string bass, and percussion. So it'll be like a jazz trio.
Mm-hmm. I could maybe explain the reasons behind that. We wanted to do this program to really showcase works in progress of Northern California composers. And we spent a lot of time thinking about how best to perform these. I have a fair amount of experience going to different programs where new opera in progress was shown off, especially in New York, for instance, the New York City Vox program. And we didn't have quite the resources to do that kind of program, but we wanted to offer the composers the ability to hear their pieces with orchestral instrumentation. And so we decided to get a small group of instruments together and basically offer them, you can help me remember what those offerings were, yeah. But it was, I think, 5 or 6 different players, and they could choose from those players what they'd like to either orchestrate. In Stephen's case, he had already orchestrated the piece, and so we had to change it, but some of them have not yet been orchestrated. So the composers were allowed to take those instruments and put them to their use, and they were made available to them so that we could hear the piece not just with piano but with some instruments as well.
And I imagine nowadays, Stephen, with the technology that's available, you could very easily add any kind of instrument you wanted and without any qualm at all, and very easily.
Well, it's not exactly easy, but it is possible. It can be done.
Depending on your technical savviness, I guess.
Well, a lot of composers use Sibelius or a program like that, so it's a little bit quicker than sitting at their table writing with pencil.
And that's much easier. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, Stephen Eddins, how did West Edge find you, or was it vice versa?
West Edge put out a call for scores for the Snapshot program. So maybe Mark could talk about that.
Sure.
About
how were things selected for this?
We decided to do this. We had another concert program. And this, I should say, we're presenting these not fully staged. It's really more of a concert performance of these excerpts. Each excerpt's about 12 to 15 minutes long. I think a little bit longer in this case because we're doing the entire. It's a short opera at this point.
We're doing the first
20 minutes of it. I'm sorry. So we gave a little bit more time to Stephen, but we replaced another concert program that we had because we felt that this was much more in line with our goals and our mission. We really believe in new opera. We believe in seeing where the art form is going and helping it to go where it's going. And so we used a program called Submittable, and we reached out to different composers that we knew, and we put links on several different forums that we know composers look at, and we actually for 8 slots we had 30 submissions, and which we were very happy about, and we took a lot of time going through the submissions. Playing them, believe it or not, our music director can literally just put a score on the piano and play through them. Listening to the kinds of media that was sent to us, whether it was the score or even sometimes a MIDI recording, which they can produce from their computer,
sure.
Composing programs. Mm-hmm. And we also looked at the stories and the librettos and the way they were set, and really took a lot of time thinking about which ones we wanted to present. So that was our process.
Well, I'm very pleased that my good friend David Conte made the cut.
Yeah, he's a good friend of mine.
Sweetheart of a guy, too, yeah. So were there obviously more submissions than were actually chosen.
Oh, yeah.
Talk to me about the other works that made the cut, including David's.
Sure. Well, David's piece is about... is about one of the people that was involved in the Andy Warhol scene. And it's a lot of fun. There's a lot of different elements to it. It's a very sexy piece.
It's called Famous.
It's about Ultraviolet.
Oh, great.
And David and I have been friends for a long time, so I was really happy that his piece got picked. We're also doing a piece called Afterworld by Alden Jenks. Alden was one of the people that started the electronics music program at the conservatory. His music is really out there. We wanted to have a real range of different types of music. I mean, we're known as a company that's fairly fearless about the kinds of things we present. We also know that some people like some things, other people like other things, so we wanted a good range of different styles. So Alden Jenks' piece is kind of a riff on Frankenstein, but the opposite. The robots are creating a new human.
Okay.
Yeah. And then in our second program, we're doing a piece by Carlos Lucera called Touch. It's about Helen Keller in her later years. She had an affair, and that that became a big part of her life.
Wow.
With her second, her first interpreter, of course, was Annie...
Sullivan.
Sullivan, right. And Annie Sullivan got sick at one point, and another interpreter, a dashing young man, came in and for a couple of weeks while Annie Sullivan was sick, and Helen Keller had an affair, and it was a big problem with the relationship between Helen Keller and Annie Sullivan. So I've always heard of Helen Keller, but I never knew about her later in life. She was fascinating, a real civil rights advocate, wrote a lot, and at the same time not being able to see or hear. Really fascinating character. So we're excited about that piece. There's kind of a riff on Howard's End, and there's a really interesting piece, and that Howard's End is by Alan Shearer and Claudia Stevens. There's a really interesting piece by Linda Bouchard called The House of Words, much more a performance art piece than a standard opera. And that, we were really excited about her work. It's really different, but we really wanted to shake things up, and that's definitely the shake-up piece. And then we have a piece by Liam Wade that is possibly the silliest thing we've ever heard. It's a riff on Streetcar Named Desire called The Stranger the Better, and Blanche is played by a tenor. So okay. We really did want to add in some, Oh, I missed the William David Cooper and William Dunlap's Hagar and Ishmael, much bigger piece with a biblical storyline.
Fantastic. And this is a little bit, the Snapshot series is a bit different from West Edge. West Edge is normally doing things in unusual spaces. This is more just like a showcase thing.
It is a showcase thing. I mean, our main focus is our festival that we do at the first three weekends in August at the abandoned train station in West Oakland. And if you've ever been to this place, it's fantastic. There's no electricity or running water. They unchain the doors. We go in and we make it into an opera house. Built in 1912, Beaux-Arts building. It's just incredible.
Wow.
It's an adventure to go there. And we do a whole tent and a festival, and there's receptions after every performance. And we do three operas in 3 weekends.
I keep reading about them, and
yeah,
I got to come.
It's a lot of fun.
Really fabulous experience.
We have a great time doing it. We're definitely doing off the beaten path works. In fact, part of this new works initiative that we're doing comes from me being in New York every January for the last 6-7 years. New York in January is really new opera time, and there's a lot going on. There's the Prototype Festival, and there's especially the New Works Forum, which this year I decided not to attend because today is my son's 18th birthday.
Oh, fantastic.
Happy birthday, Evan. I had to come home for that. But there's just basically in January, all the composers are in New York showing off their stuff in different places. And people always said to me, there's so many great composers in Northern California. What's happening in San Francisco to show off what they're doing? And every time I kind of had to say, well, I don't really know of anything, and I know most everybody around here. So we decided it was us that should be inventing this thing. So it's our first year to do it, and we're having a great time.
You're filling a terrific niche along with Opera Parallel, as you know, doing some other wonderful work. It's Mark Straczynski, who's the artistic director of West Edge Opera, also the director of Why I Live at the P.O. by composer Stephen Eddins. Stephen, your music, you often incorporate music making from everyday objects, like break drums or rubbing musical glasses of water. I assume water.
Yeah, I love that. Exactly.
Is there any of that in this score?
In the first version I wrote of the score, I did have a section for the found instruments, but I figured it didn't really work with the character of the piece. So the current version is just pretty much straight instruments.
But I don't think you'd see too many operas that have a big band feel to them.
Yeah, I think
the orchestration.
That's
true enough. Let's hear a little excerpt of the vocalization, and then we'll hear the band version at the end. What are we going to hear in this track?
Yeah, this is the introduction to the opera when Sister is in the post office describing why she lives there. It's pretty much an enactment of what you just read out, the synopsis she just read.
From Why I Live at the P.O., Stephen Eddins.
Still.
A little taste of the Stephen Eden score for Why I Live at the P.O. Stephen, your other operas include Paranoia, a psycho opera with text by Philip Lopate, The Doll's House, suggested by the short story by Catherine Mansfield, and works by such literary figures as Yeats, Shakespeare, Edward Albee, and William Gillette have received some incidental music from your pen. Who turned you on to Eudora Welty?
Actually, it was my ex-wife. When we were engaged, she had heard Eudora Welty speaking at Oberlin College, and she read Why I Live at the P.O. So Elizabeth called me immediately and said, you have to listen to this. It's the most incredible story, the most incredible voice. And so I've been in love with the story most of my adult life. And at some point, Elizabeth suggests, why don't you make this an opera? This is that's the right size, and it's a small cast.
How does the permission process work for something? I mean, this is obviously a copyrighted story.
Yes.
You have to
go through
the estate?
I went through the estate and have permission to make the operatic version.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, I indulged in a rather mediocre Southern accent for the synopsis.
That was excellent.
Is it possible to direct your singers to sing with a Southern accent? Maybe that's a question for Mark.
Well, certainly. I think if it lends itself to that, I think we would certainly do that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right.
But I love it. When you first talked to me about this, you said that these are people that you feel like you know from your childhood.
Yeah, these feel like familiar characters. They feel like cousins and aunts and uncles and neighbors, just kind of eccentric and kind of out there.
Oh, I love that.
Tell us a little bit more about your cast, then. I understand that for the Fort Worth Opera Festival Frontiers program in 2013, you had as Papa Daddy Anthony Reed.
Yes,
that was
quite
a catch.
Honestly, he just really nailed that role. He's pretty terrific.
So tell us about your cast for this program.
I don't have the list in front of me.
I don't have the list either.
A terrific cast. A cast.
It's
terrific
amazing.
Cast.
Absolutely. Well, I will talk about the singers that we've brought in for this because, as I said, I literally got back from New York yesterday. So Jonathan Kuhner, our music director, has been working hard on this. We reached out to one of the great things about West Edge Opera is that we have this kind of community of singers that many of them also work for Opera Parallel and San Francisco Opera. But we have kind of a family, and there are people that we use as much as we can. We go to them often first, depending on the role. And there are many singers that have sung with us many times, and we increase those numbers. We feel like we increase our family every year. And so we simply reached out to all those people and said, hey, you know, let's put together a list of people that are available during this time. And then I started that process, and then I passed it on to Jonathan, who basically assigned the appropriate roles to the appropriate singers that are all friends of ours that have all sung with us before. So I'm embarrassed I don't have that specific list.
That's okay.
You know, can't be perfect.
That's all right. Stephen, remind me of the instrumental track that we were going to play as an outro.
Yeah, this is...
Which track number?
I've It's 16.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
So,
This is a little instrumental interlude while Sister and Mama are setting the table. They've just had a big scene with Stella Rondo, and she stormed off, and they're setting the table for this big set piece when Papa Daddy and Stella Rondo and Sister have a huge conflict. This is a little moment of repose before all that happens.
Another taste of Why I Live at the P.O. being presented by West Edge Opera. Information at westedgeopera.org. Saturday the 21st at 8 p.m. at the Brower Center in Berkeley. Sunday the 22nd here in San Francisco at the Bayview Opera House. Stephen Edens, Mark Straczynski, thanks so much for coming in today.
Thank you for having us.
Looking forward to seeing this, as well as David's piece. Another taste of music from the Why I Live at the P.O. Chamber Opera by Stephen Eddins, being presented the 21st and the 22nd in Berkeley and in San Francisco. Information at westedgeopera.org. And more about Stephen's works at stepheneddins.com. That's Stephen with a P-H and Eddins with two D's. stepheneddins.com. Still to come here on Open Air, you'll hear about the role of MC in Cabaret at the Hill Barn Theater. Keith Pinto is taking that on. Also, we'll hear about the music of Mahler that's getting a semi-stage treatment envisioned by Michael Tilson Thomas and the San Francisco Symphony. And next, well, I'm thrilled to be joined in studio by one of the greatest flamenco artists around, Yaelisa, truly one of the most famous flamenco artists here on the West Coast. She recently stepped down from the helm of the Irvine-based New World Flamenco Festival after 10-plus years and has organized a concert tour with guest artists from Spain, Andres Peña and Manuel Malena, that starts in Irvine and ends in San Francisco on January 29th. Her husband is an important part of the mix as well, virtuo guitarist Jason McGuire, known as El Rubio. Yaelisa, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you.
And Jason, welcome to you as well.
Hi.
Good to see you. Yeah. Now, Yaelisa, let's start with some basics. I think everyone's heard the term flamenco,
mm-hmm.
and some may have actually seen it in mm-hmm. performance. But what defines flamenco? It's more than just a dance, isn't it?
Oh, it's so much more. It's actually a complete culture of artists and community and gathering and an expression of sort of a persecuted people, the gypsy people. It progressed from being that element into being put on concert stages, and it's a pretty relatively new art form, about 300 years old, so it's not ancient, but one of the most popular art forms on the planet right now. Flamenco has really received a resurgence in the last 15 years, and we felt it at the New World Flamenco Festival. We feel it here in the Bay Area, which is a real cultural stomping ground for quite a few very good artists, including members of my company, Caminos Flamencos. We've been producing concerts here since 1999, officially 2000, but with guest artists from Spain, but a lot of local, very fine artists, including my musical director, who is with me tonight.
Tell me about your first introduction to flamenco.
Well, I grew up as a second-generation flamenco artist. My mother was Isa Mura, and she was a fixture here in the Bay Area from the late 50s through pretty much until when she passed away in 1997. She was fairly young, still performing, was a dancer in the beginning and became a great a flamenco singer, and was a part of the sort of the growth of the flamenco community here over the years. So I grew up with this art form since I was really in her belly.
Nice. And studying it not only from your mother's technique, but other techniques that you were influenced by?
Oh, greatly. Flamenco is an art form that is influenced by a lot of different artists. You are really supposed to form a community of inspiration, and my inspiration happened here and in Spain. I spent a lot of time in Spain, not studying in studio, but really watching my favorite artists and learning over the years. But, you know, as a second-generation flamenco artist, there's not many of us in the United States. There's a few of us, very few. I had the advantage of growing up with the art form in all its forms. I learned about the cante flamenco, which is very important. In fact, some would say the most important element of flamenco is not the dance, but the song styles that everything emanates from, and they are an extremely important part for any dancer to understand, to be able to teach to their students, and also, which is why we work with the best singers, and we're bringing wonderful singers from Spain. And so I really feel that a well-rounded flamenco artist understands pretty much the three branches of the art form, which is the cante, the baile, and the guitar.
Hear a little bit of what we might hear from this concert, Fenda Fiesta
Fin de fiesta.
Fin de fiesta.
Fin de fiesta has a very special meaning.
Okay, please.
Fin de fiesta is the actual end of a typical flamenco show. It is the expected, the audience favorite in a way, the expected culmination of the entire concert, whether it be completely improvised concert or a concert that's very mounted, where all the artists gather on stage and they one by one show their stuff in a buleria. And it's really sometimes the artist's favorite number because they really cut loose. And I think that Jason wants to play a little buleria.
Let's hear a little bit.
Ale.
Here's Jason McGuire, El Rubio, and Yaelisa live in the KLW studios.
Ale.
Yeah, Lisa.
That was just a taste.
Wow.
And I love to sing, but the singers that are going to be singing in our show are unbelievable. But, you can see why. I think for me it's important as a dancer to understand enough about the song styles to be able to sing myself. And I sing a lot to my students, and I sing a little bit professionally, but I don't, if I can work with these guys from Spain, we want to work with them. They're
nice.
Amazing.
If you just tuned in, that was Yaelisa and Jason McGuire, known as El Rubio. Jason McGuire, tell me how a guy with the name of Jason McGuire got the name El Rubio.
As I really fell in love with flamenco in high school, and it didn't really occur to me that, oh, I'm not Spanish. I just heard this music, and it grabbed me. And I started, learning all I could in Dallas, Texas, And there were some artists there. I mean, it's a small world, but, you start learning, and I started working. And when I went to New York, I started to feel this little thing of, like, who's this Texas guy? And, feeling that little bit of why kind of thing. And and I started working a lot, and I got offered a tour at one time. I won't say who, but they asked me to change my name and like color my hair and all this weird stuff. And I was like, hey, is that really necessary in this day and age, you know?
And how much are you going to pay me?
Right. But, you know, after that gig not working out because I kind of bucked that whole thing, and a lot of artists, you know, prior to me had to take Spanish names because I don't think an American public was ready for a foreigner to like be a proponent of the art form, and that really wasn't my design anyway. I was just looking to have a good time. But you know what happened was I said, well, man, maybe I'll get more work if I had at least one of those fancy nicknames. So the gypsies often would give artists nicknames depending, you know, a lot of just characteristics of their appearance or foods they like to eat. And El Rubio just kind of popped out. Jesus Montoya, one of the singers in our show, was the guy who christened me.
Right.
You know, the folklore is it has to come from a gypsy. They baptize you with your flamenco name. And and so it was all legit.
Nice, nice.
Now I guess I'm an honorary gypsy.
So, yeah, Lisa, you're a team in more ways than one.
Yes.
How did you meet El Rubio?
Well, I met El Rubio in Los Angeles when I was working with his partner at the time, Pedro Cortes.
Was he El Rubio or was he Jason
no,
McGraw?
No,
he wasn't quite El Rubio, but he was very Rubio. And he had that long blonde hair, which, you know, and when came walking down the aisle of the theater, and I thought, who is this guy? Wow, he's kind of cute, too. And so I met him in L.A., and then we met again in New York when I hired him and his guitar teacher partner, Pedro Cortes, for a show in New York. And, you know, it blossomed from there. He decided to take a chance and move to California, and I think he agrees it's one of the best decisions he made. And
oh, absolutely.
We
That's wise answer. Good answer, Jason.
Oh. Very, very smart answer. We formed our company based I had just come back from Spain. My mother had been sick, and so I had to move back to the Bay Area. I'm an actual native that spent 10 years away in Spain and L.A. and other places, you know, forming my career, and moved back here in 97, and we've been here ever since producing and bringing artists. And, you know, we have a show coming up that's very dear to my heart because it is the culmination of more than 10 years. The press release is a little wrong on that. I was the artistic director of the New World Flamenco Festival since the year 2001.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And we, at that time, was the golden age, I call it, of flamenco in California, where there was money, there was a growing interest, and a festival like that at a smallish theater, 750-seat theater in Southern California, not even L.A., but Irvine, could actually survive. And we brought some really incredible artists over the years. My company performed. And so this show, Fin de Fiesta, was the brainchild of my boss at the time, Doug Rankin, and he is no longer at the Irvine Barclay. He said, why don't we do one last big hurrah show, and let's call it Fin de Fiesta, because the Fin de Fiesta, as I mentioned before, is the culmination of the entire show. So it's a play on words. So Fin de Fiesta, I said, let's bring it to Santa Barbara. Let's go to San Francisco. And so we're producing it at the Brava Theater on January 29th. One performance only with these great artists in a small, intimate theater. I'm really excited about that.
Well, tell us about these wonderful artists from Spain, Andres Peña and Manuel Malena.
Wow, Andres Peña I've known for years. Andres is a fabulous bailador de flamenco. He has grown. I've known him literally for 15 years. His own company is shining example of a great choreography, great dancing. And he's only been to California once before when I brought him in 2008, and he hasn't been back. So he was my first choice to come and be my guest artist, along with our longtime wonderful singer from Jerez de la Frontera, Manuel Malena, who is one of the greatest flamenco voices in Spain right now. José Cortés, another fine artist that works with us frequently. My dancers, Fanny Ara, Melissa Cruz, Clara Rodriguez, Jason, of course, and our percussionist, Marlon Aldana. We're basically going to, you know, climb up on stage and do the kind of flamenco that we love, which is highly improvised, not super mounted, not super put together.
I was going to ask about the improvisation mm-hmm. element of it. A lot of it in the guitar. Is it also improvised in the voice, just on a topic, on a subject that you're thinking? Is it
sometimes. The verses themselves have been passed down from generation to generation, the song verses. But each singer interprets them differently and personally. It's a very personal, individualistic way of expressing the cante flamenco. And sometimes they change the words. And sometimes they make up whole verses, like whole verses at a time, and then you're thinking, where did that come from? But yes, there is improvisation in all the elements, including the guitar, including the dance, and I think a good flamenco show has a lot more of it than most people would expect. And Caminos Flamencos is known for that.
Yeah, the roots of the art form are definitely improvisational. It's what drew me to flamenco as a kid. It was like, you know, you're in a rock band one minute, you're studying classical guitar the next, and you're like, hey, is there somewhere in the middle, you know? So, yeah, the singing, we don't ever really know what the singer's going to sing next. There, once you hear the first line, you're like, oh, I've heard that one before, and you kind of know where it's going.
Mm.
But it keeps everything very honest and in the moment.
So does the guitarist set the mood for what the singer might then come up with?
We trade off, yeah.
Okay.
We'll try to inspire one another or one-up one another.
All right,
you know,
yep.
It could be that vibe. And then we're, you know, once somebody takes the reins, we kind of go into support mode and try to lift them up and try to get them over, you know, over the hump and try to make the best, you know, presentation for that moment that we can. And I think improvisation and in flamenco in that way has fallen out of fashion, unfortunately, in theatrical performances. You know, we've always been really wanting to make that the important part of what we do, and one of the things that's different than a lot of the flamenco that you can come across in the United States is a lot of it's very, very rehearsed, and I respect that. That's you know, great show business practice.
We've done
there.
It too.
All right. Well,
we've just become comfortable with being ourselves in the moment.
Well, I'll let you choose what moment that is now, whether it's inspirational or one-upmanship now, as we say goodbye to this segment, before mentioning that CaminosFlamencos.com is where you can find out information about the concert here on San Francisco on the 29th at the Brava Theater in the Mission and elsewhere to learn more about the performances of Caminos Flamencos. Let's hear some more. Thank you so much, yeah. Jason McGuire and Yalisa for coming in. El Rubio, I should say.
Thank you, David.
Jason McGuire, El Rubio, performing with Yay Lisa here on the 29th of this month at the Brava Theater in the Mission. Information at CaminosFlamencos.com. Yay Lisa, Jason, thanks again for coming in.
Thank you, David.
Of course. Well, as they say in the world of the BBC and Monty Python, now for something completely different. Michael Tilson Thomas conducts the San Francisco Symphony and Chorus in an original MTT-conceived semi-staged production of Das Klagenlied this weekend at Davies Symphony Hall. His collaborative artists include soprano Joelle Harvey, mezzo-soprano Sasha Cook, tenor Michael Koenig, and baritone Brian Mulligan, with projections by Adam Larson, sets by Ellen Lenbergs, lighting by Pablo Santiago, and costumes by Sarah Schessler, to create a dark fairy tale kingdom where two brothers battle for a queen's love. The production is directed by James Dara, who joins me in studio. Great to see James again here in studio in temporary quarters.
No, it's good. That was amazing. That was cool. Oh, I got to sit and listen to that. You should have like shots lined up, though. Or
oh,
something.
Yeah, that would I go.
That's your new program, right? It's like shots and Shostakovich or something.
Well, James, I think we talked with, last time about one of your other projects with the symphony, which have included semi-stage productions of Peer Gynt, Peter Grimes, the Mrs. Solemnus.
Yeah, I was here with
Peter on the town.
Yeah. Oh, thanks. Yeah, I was here. I saw you. It was an intense summer. It was sort of Peter Grimes from that into the Marla Don Giovanni. So it was a San Francisco summer for me.
Right.
That year.
It was neat,
but very fun. So yeah, now we're tackling some Mahler. MTT and I are sort of looking at how to bring this work that, you know, in some sense wasn't written to be staged.
Right.
In any way.
Well, let's get people up to par as to what was going on before we get into your specific contributions. Mm-hmm. Let's whet our listeners' appetites to that. It's a rather juicy story you've been handed, written by a very young Mahler in his late teens, with a text by him as well. The basic story: a beautiful, proud, and man-hating queen has conceded that she will give herself as wife to whichever knight finds a certain red flower in the forest, a flower as lovely as herself. There's no ego there. Two brothers set out to find that flower. The younger is sweet in manner and handsome. The elder could only curse. The younger brother finds the flower, sticks it in his hat, lies down to sleep. Finding him thus, the older brother kills him, takes the flower, claims his prize. A musician wandering through the same forest finds a gleaming white bone, fashions a flute from it. The first time
It gets weird.
I was going to say, the first time he plays his new instrument, it sings the tale of the murder.
Yes.
Lovely.
As bone flute things that you make in the woods do, right?
Of course, yeah. Well, witness to that.
Yes.
And so he decides he has to seek out the queen.
Right.
And at court, there's a great feast in honor of the impending wedding. The minstrel arrives, plays his flute, which again tells its dark tale. The new king seizes the flute, puts it to his own lips, which accuses him direct. Such drama.
Accuses him of the murder, and then everything comes crashing down around them and burns, and everyone flees in terror, and that's the end.
Oh, love it.
Yeah, so it's...
And they all lived happily.
Yeah, and what's amazing is that's kind of the story that's told, but none of those characters are in the piece, right? It's all told sort of as an omniscient fairy tale being told to someone.
Oh, okay.
And that's kind of the challenge in it, in a way, is that it's four soloists that you mentioned, right? An SATB sort of arrangement, a quartet of soloists, a very large choral component. And the text, the German text, kind of coming from two sources, including Grimm's fairy tales, and that story alone is very different, but includes kind of a similar structure of brothers, a murderer, and then a wandering musician finding this skeleton. But, you know, there's already in the tale, there's time is kind of in a bizarre place where it's been enough time for this body to turn into a skeleton and be covered by the forest, but yet the guy is just marrying the queen back in the kingdom, and there's, you know, so...
Yeah.
So
suspension of disbelief.
Yeah, it's like suspension of disbelief, but also it really is kind of taking the narrative and making it more about poetry and an emotional feeling all the way through, and something very non-literal. So it's a huge challenge then to, you know, this team of designers has worked on operas, has worked on a lot of different things. Even On the Town, we have some of those same designers back, and that's a very linear narrative, a very structured thing with scenes, and you kind of follow it in a different way. And Mahler is so expressive and evocative, and it's and we kind of decided early on in conversations with MTT, we have the luxury of being really kind of developing ideas in tandem with him constantly. And one of the things we talked about was a way to heighten what's happening musically, almost as if we're taking a poem and making that come to life on stage. So the quartet becomes these storytellers, and we've actually, there's two children now embedded within the staging. And the entire piece kind of is seen through their eyes in this room that goes through transformations. Like you would as a child, you're being told a story, even a bedtime story. You imagine yourself as certain characters within the story. Your mind's eye pictures, you know, a forest and a pathway of this musician wandering down and finding this skeleton. And
Nate.
You start to do those things. So we've tried to find a way to evoke that without being overly literal.
So how do you direct? I guess aside from the symphony or full symphony orchestra and the chorus, you're not really directing them. You're directing more of what visually seeing with the way the singers are moving and the way that the what we're seeing. On
yeah,
stage.
We're creating a visual landscape that that bolsters and I would say enhances what's happening musically. It's in a way it's. Michael Tilson Thomas has kind of invented a new form that plays on, you know, full operas are sometimes done in concert or in what they would call semi-stagings, and this really isn't that. I'm not really semi-doing anything here in the room. I mean, we're kind of all, it's a lot of design, and it's a lot of thinking about how to best put...
Tell the story.
Yeah, tell the story, but put Mahler's piece on stage in a way that feels visually interesting, but also feels born of what's happening musically. There's huge orchestral gestures in the piece.
Oh my gosh, we'll hear a little bit of that.
Yeah, and it's not about condensing it into a frame like you would in an opera house. It's not about a linear narrative with characters playing distinct roles. So, you know, Joelle Harvey, who's the soprano, kind of, she's evoking these different aspects of the story all the way through, and Mahler at times is very interested in, I would say, atmosphere and emotional sort of outpourings versus kind of nuts and bolts story. Like, the murder isn't actually, it's in the music, but it's not actually in the text. It never says, like, the older brother then stabs him.
Oh, I see, yeah.
There's just this big, massive, impressive chorus talking about the glint of the steel as he pulls out his sword.
Oh.
And that's it.
Wow.
And then in the music, you kind of hear where the murder would be. So we've tried to find a way to evoke that, you know, without having people wander around and just try to sort of reenact the whole thing. Yeah,
sword fight kind of thing. What's so exciting, too, is that this is the first time this has ever been semi-staged, too. The work is pretty amazing.
Is that true? I don't know.
I think so, yeah.
I mean, I can't think of anywhere that, you know.
It's MTT's idea.
Yeah, exactly. And I've certainly never done it before. It's been a really fun challenge to get into it. Absolutely.
Also on the program, Mahler's Blumen and his Lieder eines fahrenden Gesellen, or Songs of a Wayfarer, with texts by Mahler as an Ersatz autobiography in poetry and music. The performances are Friday and Saturday at 8, Sunday at 2. Not to be missed. sfsymphony.org for more information. James, we could spend a full hour talking about additional projects, and I hope you'll extend my... Please come back.
I would love to. Yeah, no, I always have fun here.
Let's hear a little bit of the Mahler from Das Klagende Lied. It's truly an early Wagner. We'll hear almost a touch of Wagner in it. Early Mahler, and you'll hear also almost a touch of Korngold in this film-type music.
And if you needed anything to feel, you know, writing this at 17, I'm like, oh man, I am way behind in my own life.
Thanks, James.
Yeah. We'll be right back.
unmistakably Mahler, Das Klagende Lied, being semi-staged by the San Francisco Symphony in a Michael Tilson Thomas conceived production directed by James Darrah. Again, performances are this weekend, sfsymphony.org for more information. Winding down another hour of open air in 2017 to talk about our good friends at the Hill Barn Theater. They're continuing their fine offerings of Broadway with the classic Cantor and Ebb Cabaret, winner of 12 Tony Awards, 3 Drama Desk Awards. It's being staged January 19th through February 5th. It's based on the play by John Van Druten and stories by Christopher Isherwood, the show that made Joel Grey a household word, later Alan Cumming in the Broadway revival. The Hill Barn production has as its MC Keith Pinto, who joins me in studio. Hi, Keith.
Hi.
Well, Keith is an actor, singer, dancer, choreographer, rapper. I love that's a separate category from musician and educator. Currently teaching at San Jose State University. He's a graduate of the Pacific Conservatory of the Performing Arts, has toured Europe with fame, and is co-founder of the hip-hop band Felonious. Right. You know, I know I made fun of the rap thing earlier.
Oh, yeah.
Now so mainstream to all audiences, mm-hmm. especially with the musical Hamilton.
Yeah.
So does rap figure into your work as educating young people, as you do in schools?
Yeah, through hip-hop arts, definitely. I mean, I teach hip-hop dance at San Jose State, so very specifically, yes. But my company, Felonious Band and Theater Company, we've worked with youth for decades using hip-hop arts to inspire and often help them create their own work.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
It's a powerful tool.
Getting on to what you've been doing recently on stage.
Yeah.
You were recent understudy for the role of Stephen Kodai in She Loves Me
yeah.
at SF Playhouse, which ends this weekend.
Yeah.
Now, busy overlap with Hill Barn preparation as the MC, I guess, huh?
Yeah, pretty much.
It'd be interesting if you confused the roles and
right?
went on to...
That wouldn't be good. They're definitely very different. Yeah, that was really fun. I wasn't really an understudy. I was actually a replacement.
Oh, okay.
So the actor who's playing the role, he had a one-week conflict, so they hired me to come in and take over
great.
His role.
Oh, so you actually did the show?
Oh, yeah. I did, I think, 7 or 8 performances. So it was totally fun. It was a great show. I don't know if you got to see it.
I did.
You saw it. Yeah. Really, really lovely show, and the cast was awesome and friends.
Cleverly produced.
Yeah. Really, oh, yeah.
Still can catch it through this weekend, by
yeah.
the way. So did you ever understudy for a role that you actually got to get on stage for?
Yeah. When I was on tour back in... I was an understudy for 2 lead roles. And, you know, on a tour, people go out all the time. So I went on for those roles. I mean, a lot. I don't know how many times.
Right.
It was a lot.
Yeah.
But in regional shows... I have gone on before. Man, it was in a production of Forever Plaid at PCPA.
Nice.
This is after I graduated and stayed and worked for them over the summer and did a production of Forever Plaid. And yeah, I went on for Frankie.
Sweet.
That was, I mean, it's all, if you're an understudy and you don't know you're going to go on and you find out, you know, an hour before the show, it's scary, but... but a lot of fun.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the Hill Barn production.
Yes.
The musical and the film are different, mm-hmm. only overlap in part. Where do you go for inspiration? Obviously, there's the movie, there's the Joel Grey character, there's the Alan Grey Alan Cumming interpretation.
Uh-huh.
Where do you find a middle ground, or you just make it your own?
Well, we are doing the 98 revival version, so it's hard not to... invoke some of Alan Cumming. I mean, it's an iconic show. It's an iconic role.
He really reclaimed it.
And he made his own sort of iconic version of it, right? So, yeah, I would have to say that there's inspiration there.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, I try to find my own angles.
Well, it also has the potential for being a PG-13 or older production. How does this production rate?
This one is pretty much for mature audiences only. I think that's even how Hillbarn is billing it as well. They've told their subscribers, okay, look, folks.
Shade your eyes.
Yeah.
hide your children.
Yeah.
Go out on the town with a babysitter.
Yeah, exactly.
Hire a babysitter.
A good date night, hire the babysitter, yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of grit and sexualization and just sort of seedy underbelly of 1930s Berlin. But it's a lot of fun to execute.
Sure. Who are the Sally and Cliff of this production?
So Melissa Wolfclane is playing Sally Bowles. And
we're getting some feedback from the back about who our Cliff is.
Sorry,
no,
I'm just
okay.
On the spot. My brain is
our
going.
Our opera people had the same problem, so you're you're on the same boat.
So Brad Satterwhite is playing Cliff.
Okay, great.
And they're fantastic. They have great chemistry. It's been a lot of fun to watch them.
Cabaret is at the Hill Barn through the night. The 5th of February, our favorite local theater production, hillbarntheater.org. Dangerous question, what's next for Keith Pinto as an actor?
Well, actually, my next thing is as a director/choreographer. I'm going to be directing and choreographing Altar Boys at Center Rep in the spring.
Nice.
So that's my next thing.
We'll look forward to hearing about that, Keith. Thanks for coming in today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Of course.
Welcome, bienvenue, welcome. Fremda. Étranger, stranger, glücklich zu sehen, je suis enchanté, happy to see you, bleib, rest, stay.
The incomparable Alan Cumming in Willkommen from Cabaret, Cabaret, Cabaret. That's Open Air for this week. My thanks to Niels Swinkels for producing the show, and thanks to Peter Robinson for hosting last week in my absence. Our shows are archived at kalw.org. Look for the Open Air tab in the menu section. And if you've got a program segment you'd like to suggest, by all means, send me an email, david@kalw.org. Coming up next here on Local Public Radio, KALW San Francisco, an hour of news from the BBC recorded an hour earlier at this time, after some headlines from NPR.
Outside. So, life is disappointing. Forget it. We have no troubles.